PBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Anne Scott James, Dennis Norden, Dillis Power, and Frank Muir. Here's round one to try and test their respective vocabularies. Two marks if they get the meaning of these words approximately right. We begin with Anne Scott James. Anne, what is the meaning of polythalamus? P-O-L-Y-T-H-A-L-A-M-O-U-S, polythalamus.
Well, the poly part means many.
Yes.
And the thalamus part means something to do with the bridal chamber, so it means somebody who's rather promiscuous, I should think, or has many many bridal rooms, chambers.
Cut out honeymoon hotel.
Cut out the bridal on your right.
Well, with many rooms.
Hold on. Two marks. It's having many rooms or chambers, though it's not usually used of well-known hotels. It's a natural history term, normally. Of course, that might count, too. I don't know. Frank Miller, what is a muchacha?
A muchacha, Jack, is a South American dance danced by old cows. But it is South American, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it could be
South
American.
Who is that? Muchacha. It's a girl. It's a muchacha, as a thing from a muchacho.
Yes,
it's a he muchacha.
Yes.
One's a girl, one's a boy.
It'll do. Two marks. Now, Dillis Power. Dillis, what is the meaning of colubrine?
Nothing to do with colibri, which is a snake.
Yes.
Snakey.
Snakey?
Snakey.
Snakey, that'll do. Snake-like. Colubrine. It can mean snakey as well, or cunning. Yes. Two marks it is. Dennis Norden, what is zootomy?
Well, it's zootomy. You know, you think I don't know, don't you? it's the art of testing the bathwater with your elbow. You say it, well, I don't know, it doesn't feel so up to me. otomy is something that's, anything that's otomy is cutting up. It's
yes.
rather nasty.
Yes.
It's cutting up a zoo.
Dennis, you don't need the whole zoo.
Cutting up animals.
Yes, all right, that's quite right. Two marks it is. Zootomy is the dissection or anatomy of animals other than man, which is a help.
Woman.
I don't think so. I think she comes in under the general heading men. It's tough. Two marks. Well, before we begin round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down, and I want the two women members of each team to go on studying those quotations during the rest of the program, because at the end I shall ask them where the quotation comes from. And Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden, your quotation is, "The concessions of the weak are the concessions of fear." And Dillis Powell and Frank, yours is, "Stone walls do not a prison make." And then at the end of the program I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their idea of how these came to be said or written. Well, the next round's about verse and poetry, and what I do is to give each member of each team a quotation and ask them to complete it with the next line or two. Two marks if they can finish the quotation, and two more for correctly naming the source. Anne Scott James. "Oh, the girl that I loved, she was handsome. I tried all I knew her to please."
That's a song.
Yes.
"He flies through the air with the greatest..."
Yes.
"The damned young man on the flying trapeze."
Yeah. Yes, I think that's all right. Four marks. It's quite likely traditional, but in one book it's given to a chap called George Laybourne and the music by Alfred Lee. But it's correct, I think, enough to say that it's traditional. Frank Muir. "When I was a bachelor, I lived by myself and I worked at the weaver's trade. The only thing that I ever did wrong was to woo a fair young maid. I wooed her in the winter time and in the summer too."
Filthy.
It's one of these smutty folks, aren't we? We at the BBC are trying to stamp in. It's the only thing I ever did wrong was keep her from the foggy, foggy dew.
Yes, that's good enough, format. I wooed her in the winter time and in the summer too, and the only thing I ever did wrong was to keep her from the foggy, foggy dew. Anonymous, I think. Four marks. Dearest pal, and they bought a pig and some green jackdaws and a lovely monkey with lollipop paws and 40 bottles of Ringbow Ree and no end of Stilton cheese.
Edward Lear?
Yes.
Is it the Jumblies?
Yes.
The Jumblies. They went to sea in a sieve, they did.
Yes.
A sieve they went to sea in Irish. Oh, where are we now? What is
it? Yes, it's just I want you to do the next bit. And no end of Stilton cheese. Far and few.
Something about their hands were green. No, I don't
know. Yes, that's right.
Their hands were green.
They were. No, I helped quite a lot. Two and a half, I think. Edward Lear, the Jumblies, their heads are green and their hands are blue. And they went to sea in a sieve. Two and a half. Dennis Norton. Charlotte was a married lady, and a moral man was Werther.
Oh, yeah. This is always in all the books of comic verse. And it's something about he was born home on a shutter somewhere.
Yes.
And I don't... Is it C.S. Calverley? It's some kind of 19th century...
19th century, yes. A little earlier,
comic verse writer. I honestly don't know.
Try and finish off the verse, if you can, Dennis. Charlotte was a married lady, and a moral man was Werther.
All I can remember is somebody was born on a shutter. Or born home on a shutter. He wasn't, you know.
He didn't begin life on a shutter.
I think one mark for knowing how the story went. This is Thackeray, Sorrows of Werther, and he was guying Goethe, this is rather difficult, the German poet, who wrote a great romantic thing about the sorrows of Werther. And it runs, Charlotte was a married lady, and a moral man was Werther, and for all the wealth of Indies, would do nothing for to hurt her. Come on.
Oh, he also said that she kept on carving butter or something.
That's right, yeah. She did, that's it. Now a round of origins and derivations. Three marks if you can define the present meanings and then give me the origin and derivation of these words or expressions or phrases. Anne Scott James, desert rats.
Well, it comes from the last war, in the desert war in North Africa.
Yes.
And the desert rats were the British troops in Libya.
Why were they called desert rats, and who called them that first?
Rommel.
No, it wasn't Rommel. You're getting right, you're getting near it.
Well, the Germans called them desert rats as a term of abuse, and then they sort of adopted it. With pride.
It was used, yes, it's absolutely right, but it was used before the Germans got there. We were fighting somebody else first.
Italians.
Oh, dear, I don't know how many to give you. Two. Desert Rats was the nickname for the 7th Armoured Division, which was already in the Western Desert before the outbreak of the war, and served with the 8th Army right the way through the North African campaign and afterwards right on into northwestern Europe. And its divisional sign was this red desert rat on a black background. There was also the 4th Armoured Brigade, which had also been in the desert a long time. They used a black rat on a white background. But the name was originally given by Mussolini in an insulting sense, and the division then adopted the words proudly and, of course, rather sort of saw Mussolini off. Two marks. Frank Muir, leaves of a book. Why are they called leaves?
Well, the biggest one's called a folio.
Yes.
It's presumably the same root as foliage.
Yes.
Papyrus was a leaf, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right.
It was a leaf of a reed.
Yes, well.
So presumably uncouth chaps, you know, who hadn't learned how to make paper, tread trees and add glue and stuff, used to write on leaves.
Yes, you are actually right. Well, obviously, the leaves of a book are its pages, but before paper was invented, one of the things you used to write on was the leaves of certain plants, and as Frank rightly said, a folio, which now means a sheet of paper numbered in the front, or the double sides of a big ledger, comes from the word, Latin word, folium, a leaf.
Dearest Paul, Acme. A-C-M-E. Acme. Present meaning and derivation.
Means the top.
Yes.
I know where
it's
it comes
a Greek
from.
Word.
Yes.
I know where it comes from.
Do you? Come on, then.
It comes from the Duke of Montrose's dying words, just before he was executed. He said, "Do not act me as you did my Lord Russell."
You've got the present meaning, and you've got which Greek word it comes from, but it does mean something else, and this is rather medical. Acme. I'm not going to get it. One and a half.
No.
Acme means the highest pitch and comes from a Greek word meaning the highest point, but it was originally the term used by medical writers for the crisis of a disease, and they divided the progress of a disease into a number of stages, all of which had Greek names. The first was arche, or the beginning of the disease. Then there was the anabasis, or increase of the disease. Acme was just the absolute top of the disease when it was at its utmost violence. And then paracme was the decline, so that was the highest point you reached, and you either survived or you died. Dennis Norden, to strip to the buff.
Well, it means to take all your clothes off, Jack.
Yes. But why?
Well, to have a bath. On that, I will not be drawn. To have a bath. And the buff. Why should it be the buff?
You're buffing your nails.
That's what I was thinking, to the polished bit. You.
No, that's
you have
a,
any
that's
polished bits that you've stripped to?
Oh, something to do with buffo, is it? The Italian
yes.
word?
Buffo, yeah.
Yes,
buffo, you know, that
It's a French word, it comes from.
French.
Boeuf, to strip to the beef.
That's what it is.
You strip you're to getting the flesh, the meat.
Yes.
Boeuf. You see, the ros, you know, if you're suntan, it's ros beef.
It means, as Dennis says, to strip to the bare skin, but buff was the name given to a soft but quite strong leather prepared from the skin of the buffalo. That was the word I was trying to get out of you.
Oh.
And hence to any light-coloured leather. And because it was light-coloured leather that you said buff meant skin.
I don't think we'd have got there.
Now, the who, why and what round, 2 marks again. Anne Scott James, who comes to mind when you hear the expression the Flanders mare? And why?
Was she one of Henry VIII's many wives?
That's Anne of Cleves.
Anne of Cleves.
Yes. Anne of Cleves was Henry VIII's fourth wife, and when he saw her, he'd seen a rather flattering picture of her first, and she didn't live up to the specification.
Well, she must have been divorced then.
He hated her, married her in January, and divorced her in July, but she ended quite luckily, because unlike a good many of the rest, she lived on to die in Chelsea, I think, in 1557. 2 marks. Frank Muir, another question connected with another merry monarch. When Edward VII was Prince of Wales, and indeed I think afterwards, he was fond of attending shooting parties. He always used to shout out, "Where's the boy?" What did he mean?
Dillis has written rather illegibly, champagne.
Yes?
Quite what's that got to do with the boy?
I'd buy, bring the champagne.
Yes?
Were you there?
Yes.
All right, 2 marks. When Edward VII said, "Where's the boy?" or shouted, "Where's the boy?" he meant, "Where's the champagne?" And what happened then was that a boy with an iced bucket of champagne would be rushing in, and every time that Edward VII grew thirsty, this is what he shouted. So that for a short time, this was what champagne was called. 2 marks. Tell us, Paul, what do you know about doodling?
Well, it's what I've been doing all this time.
Mm-hmm.
Scribbling on a bit of paper.
And where does it come from? Where does it first turn up?
Well, I've heard it said that it first occurred in a film.
Yes? Which film?
Yankee Doodle.
Mr. Deeds.
Huh?
Mr. Deeds. Mr. Deeds comes to town.
Yes, that's right. Yes. It was used in another sense by the Scots. It meant then, doodling, playing the bagpipes, because the bagpipe was called the doodle sack. 2 marks. Dennis Norden, who or what was Pongo?
It's either what the soldiers call the Marines, or it's what the Marines call the soldiers. They call them pongos, don't they?
Yes, Marine, you're dead right. But I don't think it was the soldiers who said that.
The Navy.
Oh, yes, regular right. Navy.
Yes, I think that's good enough. 2 marks. It does, in fact, mean quite a lot of things. It meant originally a large anthropoid African ape, and then a Sherman's monkey. And I think this was being rude to the Marines, and that's why the sailors called the Marines pongo. It was also used of Australian infantrymen in the First World War. And there, apparently, it was after an Aboriginal name for a flying squirrel. Now we come to the last round and go back to those quotations I gave the teams earlier in the programme. For 2 marks, and Scott James, can you give me the origin of your quotation? The concessions of the weak are the concessions of fear.
Well, those tremendous political pronouncements are usually apt to be Burke.
Yes. This is Edmund Burke speaking on the American colonists who'd rebelled against England. And Dillis Powell now, can you give me the origin of your quotation? Stone walls do not a prison make.
It's one of those cavalier poets.
Yeah.
Nor iron bars a cage. Lovelace?
Yes. It's Richard Lovelace, cavalier poet. The poem is called To Althea from Prison. Well, now I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their explanations of how these quotations came into being. And on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. So back to Dennis Norton and his quotation. The concessions of the weak are the concessions of fear.
Said by Edmund Burke, statesman, orator, all-round good egg. Now, would you believe that I said this at the top of my voice only last week, without a syllable altered, in a trolley bus? The reason why it came into my mind is because I'd just come from a meeting with a man who summoned me to him, and he said, I've heard you on this program on the wireless where it said that you are a member of the society, the RSVP, which is the Royal Society for the Verification of Proverbs, which is a thing I have spoken about at great length on this particular program. It's a sort of society where, you know, I do things like taking a bull into a china shop and seeing, you know, actually what does happen. And he said, we have got out. He said, we specialize in educational toys. And he said, we have got out this do-it-yourself proverb verifying children's kit. He said, I'll show you one. He said, and what's more, he said, I would like you to be the very first customer of it. It's a mere 30 bob. And I'm sure you'd like to own one. And he brought out this small cardboard box and gave it to me. And I opened it, and there were 2 pebbles inside. That's all. So I said, you said this is an educational toy. He said, hours of fun and pleasure and learning all the while. I said, what do you do? He said, well, take one stone. Take one of these pebbles. I took one. He said, press it. Press it. I pressed it, you know. He said, stamp on it. I stamped on it. He said, put your full weight on it. I did. He said, well, you imagine a child doing that, hasn't he? So I said, well, teach him what? He said, no blood, is there? So I said, no. No, I said, but, you know, that would hardly occupy a healthy child for any length of time. He said, of course not. I said, the child's got to have exercise. Exercise, got to get out in the open air. Take this pebble. So I can take this pebble up to the top of one of your hills, a high spot. Put it at the top. Let it roll. Follow it down, the little legs, the little muscles tightening. The sun shining on it. Get to the bottom, pick it up. No moss. Child finds out for himself this way, you see. I said, I think you're onto something here. Just tell me, I said, you have 2 pebbles in this. He said, yes. The other one serves not only as a spare or replacement, because children do lose things. He said, also, in itself, just by being there, it teaches the child the verification of another proverb. There is more than 1 pebble on the beach. I said, I'll take it. I paid over the 30 bob, and I was rushing it over to Frank Muir to show him this bargain. And I was sitting in that trolley bus, and I was looking at it, and it suddenly occurred to me I'd paid 30 bob for a small cardboard box with two pebbles inside. And it was at this moment of realization that I suddenly proclaimed the concessions of the weak are the concessions of fear. And when the arresting officer asked me why I had chosen this particular statement of this particular eminent 18th century politician, I said, because it was at this point that I realized that I, too, have been a bit of a Burke.
It solves my Christmas present problem, and I'm very glad to hear it. But now back to Frank Muir, and if you remember, his quotation was, "Stone walls do not a prison make."
I'm not really terribly anxious to get home tonight, because, well, my wife isn't speaking to me. We're having what we call a coolth. You see, when I do something frightful, my wife doesn't hurl things at me. She just doesn't. We don't talk. And I'm in one at the moment, you know. It's terrible, really. It's, well, actually, today is my wife's birthday. That's the trouble. She's 40... she's... she's fortunately... going to have a... Boy, she knows I always give her a present. Well, actually, I don't always give her a present, to be quite honest. I usually give her a gift. You see, I have a very old-fashioned attitude towards giving presents. Rather generous, you might think. But I believe in that old maxim that it's better to give than to receive. So I like to ration my giving, just so that I don't get all the pleasure. You see? So, but I'm quite generous. I let her give us and get the pleasure for my birthdays. But on her birthdays, I like to give her a gift every 9 years and a present every 10, because there's a whale of a difference between a gift and a present. A gift is something fundamentally unnecessary, fundamentally useless, and it's bought in a shop marked gift shop. Actually, a couple of years back, I did give my wife quite a useful gift. It was one of those sort of gimmick writing things, you know, that writes underwater and doesn't leak on planes and you don't have to refill for months. It's called a pencil. But it was marked Happy Birthday. It's the initials. HB. But on the other hand, a present, this every 10-year present, has got to be something really sort of... A present is a present. It's useful. It's good. It brings a glow to the cheek of the receiver. It's a thing like one of those sort of super electric sewing machines, you know, where the needle dances a little hornpipe. You know, and you get a buttonhole, whether you wanted one or not. That's a present. Now, this, you see, this birthday, my wife's birthday today, I had one all lined up, actually. I had this local chap who had the most beautiful little bedside clock. It was a French carriage clock. It was absolutely lovely, and I made a deal with this chap, because my wife wanted, I knew she wanted something for the bedroom, something feminine, something which suited her, and this seemed ideal. I went to collect it yesterday. Unfortunately, it had started going again, and he'd raised the price. And there I was yesterday with no present for today. And as I was walking back across the village, I suddenly noticed a poster that there's an old water mill near us, and that they were having an auction there of the contents. Not only the milling equipment, but it said also the house effects, bedroom furniture and effects. I thought, that's it. So yesterday afternoon, I nipped along there, and it was absolutely full of people bidding. And I saw an attendant in a brown coat, so I grabbed him and said, come with me, because I don't know these auctions. And we went into the crowded room, and I looked round, and this chap, I could hear him, he was auctioneering the actual grindstones, you know, these sort of 8 feet granite things which churn the thing up. And I looked around the room and suddenly I noticed, just above my head, a copper warming pan. I said to the chap, that's just the thing. and in my excitement, I pointed up at it. Now, when you're at an auction, it is most essential that you don't raise your right hand. Well, I bought it, a pair of 8-foot granite grinding wheels, grindstones, £42.15. I got a lorry and got them home, put them into the garage, and this morning, when my wife woke up, I said, I've got your present. She said, is it something feminine? Is it me? And I walked her into the garage, 2 8-foot grindstones. So, as I say, there's a cool thong at the moment. So, gentlemen, do be careful in the auctions. I mean, don't buy things like this. Believe me. I mean, they may sort of scrape by as a gift. But I do assure you, stone wheels do not a present make.
Well, by your vote, ladies and gentlemen, Dennis Norden wins the contest of the two stories, but nevertheless, the other team, Dillis Powell and Frank Muir, win the whole contest, and that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Schryan and Edward J. Mason, and presented by the BBC. ¶¶